Hi, I'm Jeremy Kirk with Intel 471, and welcome to another edition of Studio 471, which is a regular video interview series on cybersecurity. Russia is a major player in the cybercriminal underground. Also, at the state level, its advanced persistent threat groups have pulled off some of the most challenging and technical hacks. The reason Russia is such a top-tier cyberpower is rooted in its past and unique history. With me today is Alec Jackson, who's an analyst with the US Department of Defense. He's recently written a paper that describes wh how Russia's past has contributed to its current cyber status and what that means for the cybercriminal landscape. Thank you very much for joining me, Alec.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. I do want to take a moment to say that all opinions I express in this interview are my own and not that of my employer or the Department of Defense.
Very good. Let's start with Russia's strengths in STEM education and, what role that has played in the development of Russia's IT industry.
Well, Jeremy, STEM was very important to the Soviet Union. Achievement and competitiveness in S&T was foundational to how the Soviets saw themselves and represented themselves to the world and the West. And as a result, they strongly emphasized STEM in their education system. And the emphasis on STEM has carried forward into modern-day Russia, where almost 40% of Russian undergraduate students major in a STEM field, compared to about 20% of US undergraduate students. And many Russian post-secondary students pursue degrees in IT specifically.
And what happened to the funding for science, after the collapse of the Soviet Union?
Science funding in the immediate post-Soviet Russia absolutely collapsed. Between 91 and 99, Russia's budget for science dropped by about 90%. Similarly, domestic funding for Russian defense procurement fell by at least 80% during that same period. This obviously led a lot of Russian scientists to emigrate either to the West or elsewhere. But those who stayed had to find new work for the most part. There's a saying that the Russian internet was born in the kitchens of the intelligentsia because so many early Russian internet entrepreneurs were scientists and academics disenfranchised by the fall of the Soviet Union.
That's interesting. So you still have this really active education sector, and then the internet comes along. Tell me a little bit about how the internet developed in Russia after the Soviet Union collapsed.
Yeah, so I would say that the most important thing to know about how the Russian sort of internet infrastructure developed is that at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, there wasn't a whole lot of it, at least on the civilian side. This becomes pretty important later on because there weren't a lot of physical assets around for oligarchic capture later on in the later 1990s. And what infrastructure did exist largely consisted of analog telephone lines owned by the state operator Rostelecom. The early internet networks in Russia were primarily concentrated around Moscow and used that analog telephone infrastructure to provide basic services. A lot of independent Russian ISPs got their start during this period, but I would say that Rostelecom was really key to the growth of the Russian internet and created a lot of important regional, national, and international infrastructure that later independent ISPs in Russia piggyback off of to this day. I would also say that Western multinationals and nonprofits also played a pretty big role and sponsored the build out of a lot of infrastructure. A pretty important point is that a lot of it, this infrastructure was centered around universities and research centers. And it was the internet infrastructure that was set up around these sort of academic hubs that actually helped create a market for internet services in Russia outside of the major metropolitan hubs, in Moscow and St. Petersburg. With that said, they were still in sort of academic hotspots like Novosibirsk, which created what one author called an academic bias in Russian internet access. And for the ma for many, many years, the Russian software industry was concentrated in those three cities.
Interesting. And there's another interesting point that you made in the paper, which is about the how inexpensive internet access was. And so it became quite accessible in a lot of places for, considering how large Russia is, and quite cheap as well too. And so that helped with the, I guess, the accessibility aspect of it. Tell me about how then, you've got a highly educated population, you've got a developing internet. How did Russian IT professionals be able to interact with this economy? And how did the, I guess, the employment opportunities or lack thereof sort of, we'll talk a little bit about how cybercrime started to develop.
Yeah, so like I just mentioned, the build out of internet infrastructure clustered around those three cities, Moscow, St. Petersburg, and Novosibirsk, and other academic hubs. This really meant that the economic benefits unlocked by digitization were really only available to people living around places that already had that existing internet infrastructure, which is where the academic activity already was. So these are places that already were home to Russia's most educated workers. It's worth noting that, Moscow and St. Petersburg have some of the highest costs of living of anywhere in Russia by a pretty significant margin. And another problem is that the Russian economy, like many other post-Soviet economies, is pretty inefficient. And just because you have a degree in a field of study does not mean that you'll get a job in that field. And finally, I think while a lot of Russian students who go into IT and study IT cite job prospects and high wages as their motivations for choosing that field of study, it's important to remember that the reason that Russian IT companies were so attractive to the West for so long is because they were cheap. They were, relatively cheap compared to hiring, a Western firm to do it. And while the workers were generally considered to be more creative and had a greater aptitude for inventive problem solving than, say, an Indian firm, they were still employed by Western multinationals primarily on that cost basis.
And what did this mean for the development of cybercrime?
Yeah, so this means that because the Russian IT workforce is clustered in the highest costs of living areas in the country with limited wages relative to their skills, and because for reasons we'll probably get into later in the interview, the incentives not to commit cybercrime in Russia are so weak. These people have a lot of reasons to use their talents on the illegal side of the ledger to supplement their incomes.
Yeah, and there was I want to talk a little bit about corruption too and how that has influenced cybercrime. There's a sentence in your paper which I found really powerful, and it says that corruption is the glue that binds Russian IT professionals, Russian OCGs, those organized criminal groups, and the Russian security apparatus together and allows the state to leverage cyber talent outside the state to pursue Russian President Vladimir Putin's strategy of offensive defense against the West. Let's talk about the first part of that, and then and the culture of corruption is the glue that binds. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so I think it's important to think of Russia's culture of corruption as reaching deeper and broader than just monetary bribes and kickbacks. I think that, paying bribes to government officials, police, and tax inspectors of IT, by IT firms of all shapes and sizes is certainly necessary as a cost of doing business to avoid violence, imprisonment, and, ultimately, the shutdown of one's business. But I think that the threat of state violence is just as often used to coerce service on behalf of the state, and probably more so than just simple bribes when it comes to Russian IT talent. I think that in a lot of cases, hacking on behalf of the Russian state is a way for Russian IT firms to avoid violent disruptions to their places of business.
Yeah, and the theory, if they don't play ball, they're going to be shut down. So how do you think Russia's government then views the use, I guess, of let's specifically talk about cyber criminal groups, as a sort of a arm of its foreign policy. We see a certain amount of hacktivism, we see a certain amount of crossover with Russian state policy. What's your take, I guess, on how Russia views that as kind of like a I guess a tool to leverage?
Yeah, I think the Russian state sees cyber criminals very similarly to the way that it sees other organized criminal groups in Russia. I think that sees it as a tool that the state can wield to gain access to a use of deniable violence and expertise, something to be used when the state cannot itself be seen to be doing something, but still needs that talent to reach out and touch things.
And look, I want to ask you just specifically about ransomware because that has been just absolutely so devastating outside of Russia. Russia did, they took some actions against the R Evil ransomware gang, and but I mean generally and in particularly since the start of the intensified aggression against Ukraine, there's been virtually no cyber cooperation between Russia and the West. I mean, I know this is kind of speculation, but how do you think they view the sort of economic chaos that these groups that they're hosting are causing, in the West?
I don't think the Russian government cares a lot about the collateral damage that these cyber criminals cause to foreign countries. And of course, these cyber criminals are being allowed to enrich themselves financially. That's a crucial part of the bargain that the Russian state has struck with these groups. Very importantly, another part of the bargain is that these groups are basically expected not to hack targets in Russia in order to continue having a blind eye, turned to them. And as long as they do that, they really don't have to worry about prosecution, by the Russian state.
And let's talk about the war in Ukraine, and what effect that has had as well. I mean, do you see that as like pushing IT professionals like sort of into cybercrime or just simply out of Russia because of, sanctions and, sort of officially doing business with Russia these days is really, really difficult. And if you're, if you would be a, say, a Russian legitimate entrepreneur, it'd be really hard to, get your business going internationally, when the world is literally sanctioned you, into a hole. What's happening there?
I think it's both, Jeremy. I think that, it's obviously scrambled the landscape in that it's split some of the more transnational OCGs that operated, both in Russia and Ukraine, and caused people in those organizations to pick sides in a way that wasn't perhaps necessary before. But I also think that the soft mobilization that the Russian state has engaged in over the last couple of years, particularly during the first year or so of the war, when it became obvious that this was not going to be, a 3-day walk in the park, I think it's caused a lot of those people to leave Russia entirely. And as a result, I think it's put even greater pressure on the IT workers who are still in Russia to make themselves useful to the state. I think the real worry, at least for Russia, if they're thinking about this, is that the IT workers who left during the first year of the war are probably some of the most enterprising and intelligent IT workers that Russia had to offer, which could potentially create a lot of downstream effects if they do stay away and are not able to train the next generation.
The West has expressed a lot of frustration with dealing, particularly with ransomware and other financial crimes. Russia's constitution prohibits the extradition of its own citizens. And so there's been a strategy of sanctions, indictments, naming and shaming of figures in Russian organized cybercrime. What do you think? Is there, what do you think of the strategy, first of all? And secondly, is there anything that's missing that you think that could help try to bring, I guess, more consequences for these kind of, for tolerating these kinds of actions.
Yeah, I gotta be honest with you, Jeremy. I don't think that these steps have been super effective. And again, I'll repeat that this is my own opinion and not that of my employer or the DoD. But I think deterring Russian cyber criminals from engaging in sort of the more mundane day-to-day ransomware would require the United States to dramatically lower its threshold for engaging in offensive cyber action. I think there was a little bit of movement in that direction with the shift to persistent engagement in cyberspace in the 2018 DoD cyber strategy. But my sense is that was really limited to establishing deterrence around high-profile issues like election interference. I think that we would have to get a lot more comfortable doing a lot more to a wider variety of targets to make a dent in the more sort of mundane cyber criminal activity. And while I'm not a force planner and I don't have any special insight into, how we're staffed as far as the cyber mission force, I think that lowering the threshold for offensive cyber action in that way could create capacity issues for the US.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And, obviously a lot of, offensive cyber action, requires knowledge of things like exploits and zero-day, vulnerabilities. And I think that if we move to sort of treating everything as seriously as we treat election interference, I think there's a possibility that we would start burning through, our toolbox very quickly. So I think that, there's some real trade-offs there that, for better or worse, we've decided not to make.
Yeah, it's a zero-sum game, isn't it? I mean, if you're trying to counter cyber espionage and protecting national secrets and trying to obtain secrets from others versus, you got street level cybercrime, which has become very organized and very impactful. But you're right, it's kind of like, well, where do you portion your resources? And yes, we did see a nudge towards that sort of more comfort with that level of offensive action. But that's interesting. I mean, I was going to ask you, and I can probably guess your answer to this based on your last one. And my question was around deterrent effect, because there are the odd, Russian or two that get picked up, that there were a couple that just went to Miami that were involved, or in Florida, that were involved in a long running cybercrime forum called WWH. This wasn't a super high level forum. This was one that just had been around for years, but for some reason they decided to show up in Florida and try to claim asylum, and they were promptly eventually arrested. So I mean, do you think that that's sort of, is there any deterrent effect to the US or even other Western countries nabbing some of these people every once in a while when they travel and actually getting successful prosecutions?
Yeah, I don't see it having any sort of like real effect in the aggregate. These groups or individuals are just going to be more careful going forward. And I, like I just said, I think to make a dent in sort of day-to-day cybercrime, we'd have to lower our threshold for offensive cyber action that would, probably result in some real trade-offs for national decision makers.
I know a colleague of mine at Intel 471, who was formerly in the FBI, asked one person that he was involved in an investigation with, "Are you going to go back doing this again?" And this person was involved in cybercrime, and the person was, I believe, from Russia, but said, "Yeah, I'm going to go back and do that." Apparently signaling that the risk rewards, right? The reward was better than the risk, even after being busted one time. So, I don't find that encouraging. But let's step back even, kind of more broadly too, is like, what do you think that the US and its allies can do to, I guess, degrade Russia's cyber power over the long term?
I think that there have been some sort of isolated steps. I think that we have taken that I think we should do more of. It's funny that you raised that bit about charging those people who sought asylum. My personal opinion that is that that's not the right move. I think that we should be making it as easy as possible for these people to come to the US and work for us instead. Or at least step off the playing field. I think that, for instance, Georgia has become home to a lot of people coming from Russia into, fleeing these mobilization orders. And the Georgian government set up a task force to try and help these people start businesses in Georgia. And, we can argue about whether this is sanctions evasion or not, but I think that whether it is sanctions evasions or not, I don't think probably all of it is. I don't think probably most of it is. And I think that, if we were to do the math and do the cost benefit analysis of whether it makes more sense to have, even a 60-40 split of, people leaving Russia entirely and not being subject to, the Russian state's coercive force to hack on their behalf. I think the more IT talent we can convince to leave Russia, the better, and the more steps that we as the West can take to encourage that emigration, we should do that.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And I mean, even on the behalf of what do you feel about the criminal sector of Russia? Like, should we be attracting those people over, or is that just an element that should stay on the other side?
Well, to the extent that they're not going to cause trouble here, I mean, I think that, again, the more people we can take off their side of the board, I think the better. And whatever it takes to do that, I think that's something that, maybe not working for us or being employed on behalf of the West is one thing, but certainly, some degree of clemency in exchange for pledges and guarantees of non-activity is definitely something we should pursue.
Yeah, well, there's some big rewards out there for certain players in the ransomware ecosystem too that are sizable enough that you think you might be able to flip some people. But it seems like a pretty sensible approach to take to it. Alex Paper is in the spring 2024 edition of the U.S. Army Cyber Institute's Cyber Defense Review, and it's online, and I encourage everybody to read it. And Alec Jackson, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. It was a pleasure.